Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with meetings today of the House Republicans who are either trying to persuade Paul Ryan to run for Speaker or find another candidate to run against him as the Tea Party Freedom Caucus looks for alternatives while Ryan tries to seek assurances from the Freedom Caucus that he will not suffer the fate of his predecessors, Boehner and McCarthy. A longtime observer of Congress and politics, Norman Ornstein, the co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, joins us to discuss whether Boehner can get enough Republicans to vote with the Democrats to get the impending debt ceiling and other vital issues dealt with before Ryan takes the job he does not want. Then we'll assess the decisive victory of Justin Trudeau and his Liberal Party in Canada after they crushed the ruling Conservatives, winning 184 seats in Parliament to 299 for the Conservatives and 44 for the New Democratic Party. Henry Giroux, a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada, joins us to discuss how all three parties support the Keystone XL pipeline and why the leftist NDP supported the Conservative Party's austerity program that Trudeau ran against. Then finally, we will look into the growing discrepancy between the official Saudi death toll of 769 pilgrims at the recent Hajj that has not changed since September the 26th, in spite of demands from 180 countries to account for the hundreds of their missing citizens, and criticism from Iran that the Saudi royal family is covering up the deaths of over 4,700 pilgrims. Dr. Ali Al-Yami, the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss the latest report from an investigation by the Associated Press that finds 2,177 were killed in the stampede, with hundreds still missing. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist at The Atlantic and the National Journal. He is an election eve analyst for CBS News and has led working groups of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as McCain-Feingold that reformed the campaign financing system. He was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2004, and his many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track with Thomas Mann, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, also with Thomas Mann. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And today, in the basement of the House, I believe, in a caucus room there, the Republicans are meeting to try and twist Paul Ryan's arm sufficiently so that he'll give in and yield and agree to be the Speaker. But we don't know yet, I guess. And what's your sense of what conditions or what guarantees do you think Ryan is asking? Obviously, he doesn't want to suffer the same fate as his predecessor, John Boehner.
Paul Ryan doesn't want this job. That's the first thing we have to keep in mind. This is not the career path he's ever wanted to take. He didn't want to move up in party leadership. He wanted to be a policy leader. He has his dream job in Congress, which is chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and he wants to use that as a springboard, and I think he would love to compete for and win the Republican presidential nomination in 4 years or even 8 years. He's still a very young man. The speakership used to be an end in and of itself. It is an extraordinary position in American public life. It's the first constitutional position in the Constitution, in Article I, as an officer of the United States and the leader of the legislative branch. But under the Republican anarchy that we have now, it is not a winner. And I think what Ryan has done after intense pressure is to tell people that there are a couple of things that would make him considerate. The first is he is a family man. He's got small children. And the job of the speaker in the post-Citizens United world especially is whenever Congress is not in session, you travel around the country raising money. He'd be away from his family. And the first condition is let others do most of the fundraising. That would be, by the way, a big financial hit for the House Republicans, but they're desperate to find a leader. And the second is that everybody in the caucus, in their conference, will unite behind him, and he won't have the kind of backbiting and backstabbing and undercutting that occurred for John Boehner and that kept Kevin McCarthy from taking the job. And so he's not just meeting with Republican establishment leaders. He's meeting with the Freedom Caucus, the most radical group of 30, 40 to 50 of the House Republicans. If they all voted against him on the floor, and remember, this is a vote of the whole House, he wouldn't be able to get the speakership unless Democrats bailed him out. And he's trying to get them to commit not just to vote for him on the floor, but then not to undercut him when he ends up, as is inevitable, making deals with Barack Obama to keep the government open and finance the government. And that runs out on December 11th, the continuing resolution that's kept us going since the fiscal year began October 1, and to avoid, which would have to happen in the next 10 days, a debt ceiling breach, which would be catastrophic for the global economy. They don't want to do that, and it's going to be very interesting to see if he's able to get anything like those kinds of commitments. And if it's even a little bit short of that, I think he's probably going to say no.
And again, let me remind the audience I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He's a columnist at The Atlantic and The National Journal, and he was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2004, and his many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America, and How to Get Back on Track, with Thomas Mann, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, also with Thomas Mann. But surely the Freedom Caucus have a conflict of interest, don't they? Because I believe that Darrell Issa is putting his name forth, Marsha Blackburn, and two congressmen from Texas. So there are Tea Party people or Freedom Caucus people who want a job.
And Tom Flores, who's the head of the Freedom Caucus, and there are very likely to be a number of others. So there will be alternatives. The fact is, almost everybody else is either weak, has flaws, or is more divisive, in a sense, than Ryan. But what's most important to keep in mind here, Ian, is that there is a serious schism, a real breach over tactics and outcomes within the majority party in Congress. And we're past the point, as we used to have in the old days, where you'd build your coalitions to get 218 votes, a majority, and you'd reach them across party lines if you couldn't do it easily with your own party, and it was desirable to build a broader coalition. Now, you have a party that's in the majority in the House that wants to act like a parliamentary minority party, passing all kinds of things that would embarrass or undercut Barack Obama, but they can't find those votes in their party alone, and their leaders have viewed it in a different way. It is, we've got the majority in both houses of Congress. We have to be responsible. We can't go for a rolling series of government shutdowns or threaten the full faith and credit of the United States. And now you got a group of people who are saying, that's what we demand, and we demand a change in the rules so that we have more power. And of course, any group of 30 or 40 House Republicans now, if you are trying to build a majority with 247 members and 218 needed to find a majority, can basically blackmail the leadership. That's why this post of Speaker, unless you really do decide to spurn a good share of your party and build a coalition of the center with Democrats, which Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are willing to do, but no Republican who stepped up has been willing to do, unless you do that, you're in a no-win situation.
But surely the fact that Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid has called for, well, he's basically endorsing Paul Ryan. I'm a Paul Ryan fan, Reid told reporters today. That's not going to exactly win over
well,
the Freedom Caucus.
Well, that'll certainly help him with the Freedom Caucus, don't you think?
Well, is Harry Reid being mischievous then?
of course, Harry Reid is being mischievous, and which Harry does extraordinarily well. And, you know, that's just what, not just the Freedom Caucus, I should say, it's that 30 to 40, they don't even release the list of the members. They leave it up to the individuals to announce whether they are a part of this caucus. And, you know, we used to have the sort of fringe group on the right wing was called the Republican Study Committee. They had a small number of members. In the last Congress, they had 80% of the Republican membership. This is the right wing caucus, and now the Freedom Caucus has formed because they're not right wing enough. You know, the idea that you're going to have a Senate leader on the Democratic side who says, I'd be delighted to work with Paul Ryan, is just the last thing that they want, much less the 100 other Republicans who are scared of their own shadow and a primary challenge financed by the Club for Growth or Freedom Works or one of the other big organizations like Heritage Action that will put targets on their backs.
Given that there is this debt crisis looming, actually early in November, as a matter of fact, and it seems that you really need to be able to educate these people in the Freedom Caucus and the Koch brothers and others that would, and the Club for Growth that would fund people that would be prepared to shut down the government and destroy the full faith and credit of the United States and destroy one of the great assets that the United States have, which is the value of the dollar as a reserve currency. It is so suicidal and so insane that do you think that John Boehner is going to step in and basically deal with it before it lands on somebody else's plate?
I think if Paul Ryan accepts this position, then one of the things he's going to ask, I suspect, John Boehner to do is to bring up a package before Boehner leaves that will take these divisive issues off the table. Do a budget deal, do a debt ceiling deal, take it through the year, through the presidential election, maybe even do an infrastructure package, and you know, then I can manage. And then if he can't get that kind of an agreement from Boehner, which, by the way, is going to be a package that will drive the Freedom Caucus crazy, and it might not work to make them more receptive to Ryan. But if he can't get that, my guess is he won't do it, despite the intense pressure that he's under to take this post for the good of his party.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Norman Ornstein.
Sure, Ian, anytime.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist at The Atlantic and The National Journal. He is a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2004, and his many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track with Thomas Mann, and most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, also with Thomas Mann. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the blowout victory of the Liberal Party in Canada. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University, and he's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, and The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Hi, Ian.
And Henry, you're in Canada, and you've obviously witnessed this extraordinary upset and this very decisive victory by Justin Trudeau and his Liberal Party, crushing the ruling Conservatives, winning 184 seats in Parliament to the 99 that the Conservatives retained, and only 44 for the New Democratic Party, which essentially cutting them in half. It's pretty a surprise, isn't it? I mean, it's a real upset.
Oh, it's an enormous upset, and it's a welcome upset. I mean, it's very difficult. It was very difficult for people to imagine, many people to imagine that Harper could be reelected. I mean, I talked to people from the BBC, a name, I can't mention his name, but a very famous person at the BBC said he'd be leaving the country if Harper got reelected. I mean, Harper has done enormous, CBC, sorry, Harper has done enormous damage. And, he's a guy who hated democracy. He hated matters of justice. He hated matters of equality. And he was basically George Bush with a light bark.
But he also disenfranchised 1.4 million Canadians, which is really extraordinary.
You're talking about the Citizenship Act?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's hard to believe this passed. I mean, it's just amazing that he created a dual citizenship in Canada. And a two-tier citizenship. If you weren't born in Canada and you were allegedly committed a crime in another country, he could take away your citizenship, not through the courts, but actually through one of his functionaries. But I think the Liberals will reverse that decision.
So that will mean that Canadians living here in the United States will be able to vote. I mean, that was obviously...
You're talking about something else. Yeah,
what I meant, that he took away the citizenship from Canadians who had been away for more than 5 years.
Right, exactly.
And that upset a lot of expats here in the United States.
I mean, that was bad enough, Ian, but this other thing that I'm talking about, I think that's even worse.
No, it sounds like it is, and I mean, so what happened though to the leftist party? Why did the New Democratic Party go along with austerity, which was basically the main issue, as far as I can tell, in this election?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, where the Liberals actually pulled a surprise was denouncing austerity for 3 years, claiming that they were going to put money into all kinds of infrastructure and a whole range of other issues. They learned something from Greece and I think from the European left, whereas the NDP actually fell into the austerity problem once again and just sort of complaining about deficits. I mean, that's not a left position. I mean, that's actually a right of a liberal position, and it killed them.
And it killed the Conservatives, but it's incomprehensible that the left would take that position. What happened to Mulcair then? I mean, they did so well in the provincial elections in Alberta, which shocked the Conservatives in their very core constituency. The left won at the state level. So is this a leadership problem?
It's a leadership problem, but I also think it's a matter of not recognizing when politics works and when it doesn't. And I think that what the NDP did was they bought the Kool-Aid. I mean, they drank the Kool-Aid. I mean, they operated off the assumption that austerity was such a powerful issue, given the way in which, of course, Harper has trumped it during his entire campaign, that it was almost the leading issue besides Islamophobia, that they got scared, and they didn't want to cross that line. And I think it in part, of course, I think it did them in. Where I think that Trudeau, particularly around the question of economics, he was bold enough to put forward a position that basically appealed to a lot of people who recognize that we live in an age of precarity. The economy is falling apart. Capitalism is basically killing people, and people don't want to give up social provisions. They don't want to give up jobs. They don't want to give up a certain measure of security. But at the same time, that's not to argue that liberals were the only choice, ideally were the only choice that could possibly have addressed these issues. I mean, the left should have come on strong, renouncing austerity, calling for corporate taxes, denouncing the military machine, denouncing a foreign policy that still aligns Canada with the United States. And so it goes.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University, and he's the author of The Violence of Organized Forgetting and Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. So just to touch base on some of what Justin Trudeau and his Liberal Party won on, and you might ask yourself, you know, this is, will the Democrats here in the United States run on these issues? Cut income taxes for middle-class Canadians while increasing them for the wealthy, run deficits for 3 years to pay for infrastructure spending, do more to address environmental concerns over the controversial Keystone XL oil pipeline, take in more Syrian refugees and pull out of bombing raids against the Islamic State while bolstering training for Iraqi forces, and legalizing marijuana. So...
What Democratic Party, is there a Democratic Party that actually argues those issues in the United States?
Well, there's a guy called Bernie Sanders.
Well, there's Bernie Sanders. I mean, but I mean, I'm thinking about where the Democratic Party really is investing its hopes.
Right.
And, you know, that's basically in, you know, Clinton's partner, and I don't really believe that any of those issues are going to be taken seriously under her. I mean, she's a neoliberal militarized warrior. And I think that the policies that she'll produce will not surprise anyone who recognizes the way the Democratic Party has drifted to the right. I mean, the other side of this is that, you know, you have to recognize that for all the hype about Trudeau, remember, you know who one of his major economic advisors is. It's Larry Summers.
Really? Well,
absolutely. It's Larry Summers. And I think that, you know, it's one thing to say we're going to raise taxes for the 1%, but it's another thing to say we're going to raise taxes on corporations. You know, it's another thing to say that we think that Hopper was militarized the country, but it's another thing to say that's just a matter, it's around a question of tactics and strategy, not a question of saying we have to go back to Canada being a peacekeeping nation. Both the NDP and the Liberals, you know, they support the war against Syria. They just want to back different forces. Both of them believe in basically a national security state. None of them, I mean, when you think about Trudeau's support for C-51, that's shocking to me. Or when you think about his wavering on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, saying, well, we've got to really look at it and see what's in there. I mean, I think that when you see that kind of fence straddling, which you see among Democrats, you get a sense of where the wind is blowing.
Well,
it's blowing to the right.
Well, if one of the things that clearly should have happened earlier when Obama took over, when the economy was in free fall, there was a stimulus package, but everybody argued it was insufficient, and it's dragged down the economy enormously, and austerity was completely counterintuitive, as it's been proven in around the world. We have all-time low interest rates of 0.25%. It'd be a perfect time to rebuild America's crumbling infrastructure.
Absolutely.
Nothing can be done. I mean, we're talking about a totally dysfunctional polity here, but at least Trudeau's got this infrastructure a program of $10 billion for the first 2 years.
No, I want to give credit due where it should be given, and to be honest with you, for me that was worth a vote for Trudeau. I mean, I really think that he really came out swinging on that issue, and I think it worked, and I think it was brave. I mean, to say that we need to rebuild the country, we need to make social investments rather than investments in, you know, a militarized state or in a police state or in simply supporting corporations. I mean, I think that was brave. That was brave. Interest rates are low here, and it will improve the economy, and it will provide jobs, and it will suggest that austerity is not an economic policy that's viable when you have massive inequality. I mean, the other side of this is that that the income, the inequality in wealth and income in Canada is growing faster than in the United States. And so there has to be measures to maintain that. Otherwise, all this talk about overcoming austerity is nonsense, or even investing in these social programs is nonsense, because you just don't have enough money. And the people who have the power are going to control the policies, or they're going to block it. And so it'll be interesting to see the degree to which Trudeau really acts on what I think are these democratic investments that he's talking about.
Well, Larry Summers notwithstanding, he's promised that richer Canadians can expect to face a higher tax bill, which is more than half of their income in combined federal and provincial taxes.
Right, 53%.
And while ordinary people can look forward to tax breaks. So,
but at the same time, Ian, if you look at the figures around what's gained and what's lost, they cancel each other out.
So what?
In other words, there won't be any more revenue. I mean, granted, the redistribution of wealth away from the wealthy to the middle class, I think, is a good thing.
Right.
But at the same time, he's also talking about generating an enormous amount of revenue as a result of this, whereas he's not talking about a tax increase for corporations.
Right.
And it seems to me that's part of that neoliberal, soft neoliberal logic, right? It's
right.
Diversionary.
Right, but on the other hand, if you're spending the equivalent of a half of 0.5%, half of 1% of Canada's GDP, this $10 billion infrastructure deal, that's supposed to stimulate the economy, isn't it?
Yeah, if that does, that'll be terrific.
Yeah. So... But again, this is not happening here. You're not taxing the rich 50% here in the United States, I guarantee you.
Look, I mean, the difference between Canada and the United States is that while Canada has a kind of soft neoliberalism at work, it also has an enormous respect for the social contract. And I think that one of the reasons that Harper fell is because he violated that contract and redefined the nature of Canadian society as a militaristic, warmongering, sort of corporate investing social order. And I think Trudeau, in a sense, has attacked that in a way that seems to suggest that the social contract has to be maintained. In the United States, the social contract, for all intent and purposes, doesn't exist as a viable political discourse among either major party. And that's why one could argue that in the United States, what you have is really an authoritarian social formation. You know, we've talked about this before. You know, when Princeton University does a study claiming that, you know, the United States is no longer a democracy, it's an oligarchy. Right. I mean, this is not exactly the center of Marxist studies in the United States. Because policies for the last 50 years have been largely 95% of them have been written by the rich and have nothing to do with the basic needs of the American people. Why would we expect anything else?
Well, that's what's so interesting about Bernie Sanders' run for president, that in the recent Democratic debate, you know, millions of Americans heard the S word, socialism, which has been a dirty word. I don't know that he gave the world's greatest explanation for what he stands for, but he obviously stands for social democracy.
Let me make a qualification here. I'm not including Bernie in that logic.
Right. No, but I was saying though, Henry, that where social democracy has been so eradicated from
right.
our political conscience,
right.
even though effectively the U.S. had a form of social democracy from 1947 to 1977.
Right.
It has been erased, but at least Bernie's talking about it, and I think throughout this campaign, more and more Americans will learn what you are treasuring there in Canada. And the other thing that I thought was heartening about this Canadian victory of the Liberals was that Islamophobia and the kind of dog whistle ugliness that we have here in our political race on the Republican side with Trump and Carson saying Islamophobic and hateful things to minorities, the Canadian people rejected that out of hand.
Oh, they really, that was rejected. It was really interesting because, I mean, this notion that, you know, there was some kind of violation of Canadian principles around women wearing the niqab. You know, while taking the citizenship oath, I think the figure is in the last 10 years, only two women have actually appeared before a judge in which that actually happened. So it's just a silly, stupid sort of fear-mongering intervention. But I want to say two things that I think are important here, and I think you're absolutely right on both issues. One is nothing happens unless you change the discourse. you have to have a discourse that basically works outside of existing dominant discourses. And I think that Sanders is doing that. As you know, I've said, well, I don't think this is going to happen within the Democratic Party, the kind of reforms we'd like to see for obvious reasons. But I think that he's making an enormous contribution around the level of discourse that he's producing, talking about socialism, talking about social welfare, you know, holding up critique, a whole range of issues that are simply erased from the corporate media. That are not talked about, whether we're talking about extreme poverty or militarization, although he's not as good as he could be on that, or whether we're talking about basically racism in the United States, deep-seated racism. And he has to be applauded for that. And I think the real issue here is what happens when you create the groundwork educationally in which people can all of a sudden invest in a politics in which the language that they now are hearing really resonates with the conditions in which they find themselves. That excites me. Because for me, that's an educational issue. That's an issue that suggests that education is at the center of politics. You make something meaningful to make it critical, to make it transformative. And he has to be celebrated for that. Now, where that goes in terms of the possibility of a third political formation, a socialist party, for instance, is another question. But you know, given the authoritarian nature of the United States right now, I mean, the response to Sanders and the fact that he's attracting these kinds of crowds and at one level getting some terrific coverage, that's the good news. The bad news is what we saw from Anderson Cooper the other night on CNN, the red baiting. And I think we're going to see if for some reason, and I'm really hoping he wins the nomination, oh, we will see red baiting like you've never seen it in your life. Yeah, as you can imagine, right?
Right. Well, just in the last a couple of minutes, Henry, you're returning to the Canadian elections. Can you explain to our audience here in the United States why it is that all three Canadian parties, the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the New Democrats, support the Keystone XL pipeline in various degrees?
I think that what it suggests is the grip of capital on established politics. That's what it suggests. I think we enormously underestimate, and certainly in the United States, there's an enormous underestimation to the degree to which capitalism corrupts politics, just corrupts it. That it buys politicians, it puts them in fear of money being backed to sort of get them out of office, and they make unethical decisions. And I have to say, I mean, how any party could support that. And the fact that they do would disqualify them as a left-oriented party.
But the fact remains that they all do in different degrees, right?
Yes, I mean, they do.
And what are the degrees?
Well, I think that the degrees, I mean, for Harper, it was like, you know, he actually censored people, scientists who wanted to talk about it and provide evidence to the degree that it would, you know, wouldn't go through. I think that the Liberals will try to find ways to suggest that it somehow will be good for the social contract, that there'll be jobs, that, you know, there'll be benefits. We'll use that money. We'll put a cap on this. We'll try to regulate it. And I think the NDP takes a similar line. But I think the real issue is not whether you can regulate this, but why should it exist in the first place when it's poisoning the environment and killing and injuring people's lives? I mean, in other words, let's put it differently. The ethical imagination gets tempered down under this in this issue to such a degree that it begins to disappear.
Well, apparently, this process creates so much contaminated water,
right?
That you may end up, we may end up very soon where water is more valuable than oil. So
that's right.
And the native peoples up there are absolutely alarmed by it.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, remember, you know, Alberta is Harper's home, right?
Right.
I mean, the relationship between Harper and oil is my God, like the relationship between, you know, the Koch brothers and, political corruption.
Right.
Indissoluble.
Well, just in closing then, you're a happy camper.
I'm, look, I'm happy about two things. I'm happy that Hopper is out because Hopper was truly a really corrupt, awful, right-wing, mean-spirited political leader who basically has ruined the reputation of Canada and ruined many people's lives. Right. At another level, I think there's hope in that people voted against him, but we need more hope to generate people to do more than think about voting against somebody like Hopper. We need to reimagine what a Canadian society would look like if it really believed in democratic socialist ideals. And I think that's not something the Liberals are going to provide us with.
Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you very much for joining us here.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University, and he's the author of The Violence of Organized Forgetting and Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And the rest of the program is available at ianmasters.com. It'll be available around 6:30 p.m. today, local time. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the death toll from the Hajj in Saudi Arabia, where the government still insists it was a little more than 700 deaths. The Associated Press said it's at least 2,200 deaths, and the Iranians say at least 7,900 people died. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
And the Associated Press have done their own study on the numbers of casualties from the stampede at the recent Hajj in the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government still, and this, of course, happened on September the 24th, but they still insist the Saudi official death toll is 769 people killed and 934 injured. And they have not changed that since September the 26th. But according to the latest figures, there are at least 2,177 dead, and there are still hundreds of pilgrims who are still missing. So how could you have this enormous disconnect with reality? What is going on with the official Saudi regime?
Well, it's a very secretive system. The Saudi system is very secretive, and of course, there are no independent civil society or a human rights advocacy or anybody who can check on anything other than the Saudi government itself. So I'm not surprised that the numbers that the government gave is lower than it may have been, because this is, you have 2 million people and there was a huge stampede, and I don't know. I have no evidence of either the government statistics, figures, or the report you just mentioned. But I'm not surprised that, or I won't be surprised if the Saudi government is trying to minimize the losses so it looks good in the eyes of Muslims who are getting very discontent with the Saudi management of the holy places in Mecca and Medina. Many Muslims think, and I agree with that, the management of the holy mosques in Mecca and Medina should be actually under an international Muslim council that decide what needs to be done, how it's going to be done, instead of one ruling family and its religious establishment. I have to understand there is 1.65 billion Muslims, and the Saudis made less than 3% of that population. So you would think that the management of the holy mosques should be in the hands of the majority of the Muslims, as opposed to the Saudi ruling family and its Wahhabi religious establishment. Despite the fact that the holy places happen to be in Mecca and Medina, which is part of Saudi Arabia, but there is nothing in the Quran or the Sharia or the Islamic law that says the holy places should be under one government control. So it's a Muslim holy sites.
Well, but how do you explain, first of all, the methodology that the Associated Press count came from, which is about 2,200 compared to the official Saudi count of 769, comes from the countries, 30 of the 180 countries that sent its citizens to the Hajj. And so these are countries that are, you know, Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, Senegal, Ivory Coast, Egypt, Bangladesh, Indonesia, India, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and so on. The real discrepancy here,
big time. It is big discrepancy. And if the United Press or our newspaper have reported this, interviewed families who lost their member of their families, I would definitely believe those people more than I would believe the Saudi government figures. As I said, you have to understand the Saudis are known for denying reality. They have denied that Al Qaeda was responsible for attacking the United States in September 9, 2001. They still think it's Jewish, Zionist, Christian, other people conspiracy, not the Saudi nationals. So there is precedence in terms of the Saudi regime's denial, whether it is this unfortunate, and it's a tragic incident that happened in Mecca during the pilgrimage season. But and to me, the Saudi government should have been should have told the truth. So many people died. They will have more credibility than denying it, especially when they know these people who died have families all over the world, the countries you mentioned and other places. And those people are going to be reached by somebody who want to find the truth. And obviously the reporters took that responsibility seriously, and they found out that the Saudi government figure is false.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yam. He's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, a native of Saudi Arabia who has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. But I think there's something even more to this story. Just the discrepancy so far from the AP story of 2,200 to the official number of 769, that's a pretty big gap. But from the outset, the Iranians have been very clear that there's a huge number of deaths here. And in his speech to the United Nations, President Rouhani mentioned the thousands who died in the Hajj, and that was very shortly after the actual stampede had taken place. Now the Iranians are claiming that as many as 4,700 have died. So the question would be, what are the Saudis doing with all of these bodies? I mean, there's obviously, if you accept the AP figure of 2,200, which is way above the Saudi figure of 700 plus, then, and if the Iranian figure is more accurate, 4,700, you have got thousands and thousands of bodies in Saudi Arabia that are being hidden.
I'm not exactly, I trust the mullahs in Tehran more than I trust the Wahhabis in Riyadh. To me, they are all the same. But the point is, I think an independent international committee should be allowed to find out the number of people who died and the number of people who are injured because of that unfortunate and tragic incidents, because this is not something that should be hidden by the Saudi government or anybody. These people, if they died, their loved ones would like to find out if they are alive or dead. They also would like to see their remains, to bury them in their homelands, in their countries, to put closure on this miserable kind of situation. So I think a committee, independent committee, whether it's just Muslims or Muslims and non-Muslims or whoever it is, be allowed to investigate. And if the Saudi government has nothing to hide, I don't think they should have any problem with having any committee to investigate what happened in Mecca.
Well, clearly there are a lot of missing people. I mean, it's not as if anybody's even saying that the 2,200 figure that the AP have come up with is the final count. There are still hundreds of people missing, which then leads you to think that maybe the Iranians aren't that far off. So this, again, this is a very surreal situation. That why would this government hide these? What are they doing with the bodies? I mean, you know.
I think this is an extremely important question that deserves an answer, and it should be answered, and the Saudi government should be accountable, held accountable, until a very investigative groups have reached the bottom of this, because this is a human dignity we are talking about. You cannot just have lots of people dead and their families are there waiting for them. They didn't know what happened to them, and you either hide them or bury them. Or they say this is barbarity, as far as I am concerned. If these reports are correct, this is another barbaric kind of policy the Saudi government follows. Because they don't want people to know. They have been trying to convince Muslim and non-Muslim we are capable of taking care of the pilgrims and taking care of the Holy Land, and we didn't need any help with it or management from any other country, Muslims or non-Muslims. I think this deserves an investigation to get to the bottom of this thing. That's just because you and I said it, or for you and me, but for the families of these missing people.
Well, there's obviously something going on in terms of the disputes within the royal family, the ruling family itself. There was this leak from London recently of one of the princes, a grandson of the last king, circulating a letter that's very critical of King Salman, and particularly his son, who's effectively running Saudi Arabia, the 30-year-old, who has both the oil ministry and the defense ministry and the interior ministry. Well, I know he has interior, but this is where I believe there's something going on, because the other crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef bin Abdulaziz, he's apparently been relegated to cutting ribbons. So he apparently, according to the Saudi Arabian press agency, the Crown Prince bin Nayef, he is the kingdom's interior minister. But as I say, the rumors are that he's lost all influence. He apparently oversaw a meeting late on Sunday about what happened in Mina, in Mecca. And according to the official Saudi press agency, there was no mention of this rising death toll, and they're still sticking with the official death toll. And the statement from the Saudi press agency is, the Crown Prince was reassured on the progress of the investigation. He directed the committee's members to continue their efforts to find the causes of the accident, praying to Allah Almighty to accept the martyrs and wishing the injured a speedy recovery, while sticking to the original numbers. I mean, are they setting up bin Nayef to take the fall?
Well, he's the interior minister, and he's in charge of the security, the internal affairs in Saudi Arabia. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's being set up to take the blame. So King Salman and his son, Mohammed, who is 28, 30 years old and experienced, And like his father, he's very sectarian, dogmatic, and hasn't actually studied anywhere else except the Saudi religious schools, which is very dangerous in itself. So I wouldn't be surprised, because this family is known for sacrificing each other when it comes to personal interests. It has happened all through the history of the Saudi ruling family. So it's really, Saudi Arabia is facing more dangerous situation today than at any time in its history, the country itself. And partially because the royal family is having a feud within the family itself. King Salman took all the power from every other, there are many wings in the family, from other wings in the family, give it to the Sudairi family, which is his son and his nephew, this bin Nayef, and others, and excluded all of the rest of them. And there are about 6,000-7,000 blood-related members of the ruling family, let alone the other extended family, which is between 20, 30, 40,000 people. So they are facing so many problems within the family itself, and that is endangering the country and the war in Yemen and the occupation of Bahrain. And they are not actually focusing on the domestic problems, human rights, women's rights, equality, studying of sciences and technology. It remains sort of like a family company, family property, the country as a whole. In the meantime, the whole world is changing around them, not just in the world outside the Middle East. In the Middle East, in their borders, in the Gulf states, people, especially the younger generation, and there are millions of younger generation, most of their populations are actually below the age of 30 years, and this is your social media people, smartphone, computers, and they really didn't care too much about religion or nomadic life or poetry. They compare themselves with the rest of their counterparts worldwide, and they are asking questions now, men and women, why are we in the bottom heap when it comes to our either lifestyle, human rights, liberty, free expression, free press? So the Saudi people themselves are more advanced than the government that rules them. They are the government, both the political wing and the religious wing, are trying to conduct the country's affair as if they haven't passed the 7th century, especially the religious establishment. It's a mess, and you would think that because many of the Saudi younger, the royal family younger, princes and princesses, are educated outside the country. They spend most of their life in democratic countries where they could enjoy what democracy offers and deny it to their people back home. You would think some of these younger generations, men and women, actually raise their voice in join the pro-democracy, pro-social justice, human rights, non-royal members, and expose the ruling family and its old policy and old thinking, and that would save the royal family, and it actually would save the country.
Well, is that what's going on with this letter that was circulated amongst the princes, criticizing the young king for the war in Yemen, for money that's going out the window, you know, and for immature policies, etc.? I mean, it was pretty pointed.
Yeah, very pointed, and it's not the end of it. And they should listen to their own. If they don't listen to the enlightened pro-democracy human rights activists inside the country and around the world, and even President Obama, who's not exactly a critic of the Saudi regime, even he, in a recent, about 4 or 5 months ago, had an interview with the New York Times, and he said the biggest threat to the Saudi and other ruling families in the Gulf is not from Iran, it's not from Israel, it's not externally, it's from their own people. Millions of young men and women, they don't feel they have a future, and therefore they are going to create more problems for this Laura. This is Obama. I didn't say it. You can Google the New York Times, his interview with Thomas Friedman, and that's exactly what he said.
Well, how would you assess or translate this threat, given that you have the external threat from the Islamic State You have the Islamic State now getting more active in blowing up Shiite mosques. You have the oppression of the Shiites who are in the east where the oil is. Would the eruption come in terms of a sectarian strife, which the Islamic...
I hope not, because if it becomes that way, what's happening in Syria and Iraq and other places will make what happened in Saudi Arabia look like a picnic in a park. Saudi Arabia, the society is extremely divided because it has always been divided by the ruling family intentionally. They did not create the division, but they perfected it. Tribal division, regional division, gender division, all of these things are, these are fact documented, and you can see it happening. So I think the biggest problem to the biggest threat to the Saudi ruling family itself, and could be to the country, of course, is the religious establishment, which is the source of legitimacy for the Saudi regime and source of power, actually. Since ISIS began to gain power, and they're still gaining power, actually, all over the place, but their time will be also numbered. They have nothing to offer except the Sharia alone. Nobody wants that anymore. But the biggest threat to the Saudi ruling family in the country is coming now from the religious establishment, because the religious establishment is finding out it has more in common and more support among ISIS and the Nusra and the sword of the Muslim army, something like that. They are finding out they have more in common with these ISIS extremists than they do with the ruling family. They know they have better chance to survive and to continue gaining power if they ally themselves with ISIS. And this is the biggest threat to the Saudi state and the Saudi ruling family. And unfortunately, the more the religious establishment began to, and it's beginning to, and it has been going in the direction of ISIS, the Saudi regime will try to appease them, the religious establishment, which means there will be more oppression, there will be more denial, there will be denial of women's rights and religious minority rights and human rights and reforms, just to appease the religious establishment, because the Saudi regime cannot do actually much without the religious establishment, and vice versa. But now the religious establishment has more support, and some people they could go to, and that is ISIS and the other extremists that are popping all over the Arab world now.
Well, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, has lived in the United States for many years, where he's advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm